Hello and welcome to episode number 362 of the Super Horror Bros podcast. I'm your host Matt, and joining me as always is my brother Mike.
Hello.
How's it going?
Pretty good.
We are back doing something that we very much enjoy, which is not talking about a new film for a change. But kind of the somewhat finale.
I thought you were just going to say that we just full stop don't enjoy talking about new films. We're back doing something we enjoy for a change instead of talking about those shitty new films.
Yeah, it's been a year, but let's not talk about it. This is about a time to look back to a great time when great horror movies were being released, such as My Soul to Take, which we'll get to. And yeah, this is like the somewhat finale of this.
I know.
With some addendums to it, which we'll get to. But yeah, we started this like over 3 years ago in the midst of a global pandemic. We were like, let's just talk about the four Scream movies. We did that and we loved it so much that we've made, this will be the 19th Wes Craven movie added to the list, which is crazy. But it's so nice to look back on it, and we will have a somewhat, again, complete list with an asterisk to it, but we'll explain that good stuff later. Because there is some news this week. There's some weird stuff in here. I was trying to find just some, like, wacky shit that I thought would be funny to talk about, especially there's one in here that I just put as a joke. But this first one's exciting because, again, there's not really too much to add here. But it's just cool that it's close now, which is Eli Roth's Thanksgiving. It's just, I still can't believe this is real. Like just putting in the news, there was a teaser trailer. It's only like a minute long, which we don't really have to go over, but it's just cool to see it again and be like, oh, it's not that fake trailer. It is actually a real thing. Which was like over 15 years ago. And so yeah, it's coming this November. So I cannot wait to see this film. I have no idea if it's going to be any good, but it's just an Eli Roth fun slasher is good enough for me, let alone this film that has this like crazy history for me personally of just falling in love with the overall grindhouse experience. It's arguably like my favorite film experience of all time, because I can cheat and include multiple films, you know, not just one film. It's not only is it two films, but you can kind of, I think Machete is definitely a part of that as well, let alone the fake trailers from Rob Zombie and Eli Roth. I mean, it really just has so many of my favorite people, obviously Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez as well. So it's awesome. But yeah, are you as excited for Eli Roth's Thanksgiving?
Yeah, definitely am. I think for both those reasons that you said, you know, just Eli Roth doing a cool slasher, I'm like, hell yeah, like it's been too long. Like, and, you know, it really felt like he was going to be one of those guys that was going to be really prolific. And don't get me wrong, like with, you know, he's racked up a good amount of horror movies, but he should have probably done a lot more than what he has.
Done, he definitely, you know, should have.
And, you know, so the fact that we're getting an Eli Roth horror movie is incredibly exciting. And then the fact that it is just this cool, you know, trailer that came out so long ago, that we finally get like the movie of. And yeah, that's very exciting as well. It's a shame that like they didn't just use the trailer.
Yeah.
Should have just been like, this is nothing to do with the movie, but here's a trailer.
Yeah, it's been so long now, because I think we've discussed it before, but it's worth mentioning. Like, that was one of the coolest things about Machete, was they deconstructed that trailer, they made a film from it, and all of those original shots from that original trailer are in the film. And yeah, so that's amazing for them to work, and it has this janky feel, which just perfectly suits the overall tone that they're going for. Whereas with this, it's like, they could never have done that. It's been so long. But like, I loved even just in this teaser, there's a couple of bits that are like, you know, they've redone from that original trailer. I'm like, oh, it's so cool that he has, it's not just Thanksgiving. It is specifically that fake trailer for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So I'm so excited for this one.
Yeah, man, definitely.
So yeah, coming in a couple of months. This next one I just want to put in here, cause like, it's a nice reminder this is coming. And again, it's not super relevant, but I'm excited that Goosebumps is returning as a TV show. We've definitely talked about this in the news before. Again, not, you know, hardcore horror. This is much more of a kids show, but we obviously both adore Goosebumps. growing up, reading the books and watching the TV show. And that first film I loved as well. I never saw the second one. But yeah, it's cool that it's back and it's coming this October 13th. So much like everything under the sun, there's like a 2 week period in October where there's just so much content. We might do like an October preview next week. Cause it's just crazy. But yeah, this is dropping on Disney Plus. Not entirely sure which form. I think it's like a couple episodes and it'll be weekly. In the press release, it's interesting because they say the new series draws on elements from five of the most popular books, including Say Cheese and Die, The Haunted Mask, The Cuckoo Clock of Doom, Go Eat Worms, and Night of the Living Dummy, which right off the bat is very exciting.
Good bangers right there.
Yeah, amazing stories. I've read at least four of those books and really, really like them. I think what this show isn't what I want, because I don't think it's an anthology show. I think this is similar-ish to the film, which the film was different because it had like R.L. Stine as a character, which is not this. But I'm assuming this is like an original story that is a singular narrative across multiple episodes, which will then, like I say, the fact that they're saying draws on elements, they'll be like, you know, they'll have the camera.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll just rock up and, you know. And,
which is cool. I think that's exciting.
Tommy will be there and everything else. Yeah, exactly. I think it definitely is cool. And like, I shouldn't be like, and I'm not down on it, but part of me is like, oh, I just wish that they'd just redone the TV show, because I love these stories. I love anthology, and there are like hundreds of stories that can be told in that world, just retold from the books, you know. And especially those original ones. I think those original, like, was it 62, I think, in the run, like, I just remember like rereading them so many times as a kid. And so yeah, I would love to, you know, just have a TV show that was turning those out. But I guess I already had that. Could watch it if I want.
Yeah, but like, I have the most nostalgia for that show probably out of anyone. Like, I adore that show. I've rewatched it multiple times in recent years, and I genuinely do love it. But it's so old, and like, it's at a point now with Disney Plus that it would make perfect sense to bring that back, because most people aren't going to have seen that now. You know, like, the target audience was not around then. So I think that would have merit. Yeah. But I do think this is cool, and I'm definitely watching this. I don't know if I'll watch the whole thing. It'll be a case of whether or not it grabs me. But I'm excited to check it out and at least give it a chance. And I do think that the episodes that they're drawing on are cool. But like you say, that anthology feeling, and I would love to go in each week if it was the anthology.
Yeah, not knowing.
Because if you watch it and suddenly you see like Monster Blood, I'm going to lose my mind, because that's like one of my favorite ones. But there's so many that I would be like, I would pop for.
It'd be great, especially if they had like a long intro each week. So like, you had like a good 5 or 10 minutes, and I'd be like, oh man, what is it? What is it? And then like, I'm like, oh shit, it came from beneath the sink.
It's so good.
I love so many of those stories. And I think that's the thing as well. They were such fantastic kids' horror. You know, that's the thing, where it was like, it was such a great gateway for us, even though like, we were weird and watching gnarly shit when we shouldn't have been. But like, this was also there.
Yeah.
And like,
oh, this definitely, you know, this definitely and was on the same path for sure.
Yeah. And was like a huge part of what got us into horror, where it was like, you know, I remember just collecting all of these books and, you know, them watching the TV show and both being as good as each other at the time. And yeah, so like, I wish that they would do the anthology, but yeah, I'm still, cause I think like you said, the Jack Black kind of movie that came out a few years back, that was good. It served its purpose of giving a good homage to the books and also giving this good children's horror movie.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense as a film as well, because that needed to be like a new narrative. Whereas I think with TV, like say with the episodic element, it's right there to have different stories. So this is going to be interesting. Like, again, I don't know how many episodes this is, but it's interesting that they're talking about drawing elements. And will it mix and match, or will it be like a singular narrative where each week it does feel like they're stepping into that different story, but it's with the same characters? Like, I'm excited for this just to see what it is. It could end up being awesome. But yeah, it's right around the corner with every other TV show returning soon. This next one's just a bit of a laugh, really. I'm sure this won't have as much conversation as the last two news stories. But a movie I know you're incredibly excited to watch, an upcoming horror film, is the Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 2.
Hell yeah.
But you wasn't expecting that in the news this week.
Not by you, no.
Exactly. Listen, I give sometimes. But yeah, I put this in there for two reasons. The first one just for the comedic element, and also the fact that the exciting news, which was confirmed by actual news outlets talking about this film, which blows my mind. Tigger? We are indeed. Tigger is in the sequel. Which is hilarious that you guessed that.
Is this the one bit of news that Winnie the Pooh horror fans have been waiting for? You know, when we get like a Scream announcement or a Saw announcement, we're like, are we getting Tobin Bell? Are we getting Tobin Bell? And now it's like, you know, we get a Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey announcement. I'm like, are we getting Tigger?
Yeah.
So hell yeah.
And it's brilliant because it's exactly what we presumed when we watched that film, which was that he wasn't in the public domain at that time. However, by next year, he will be. So they're like, yeah,
those time lamps.
He's like, yeah, we're having that. I also love how this quote from a producer, Scott Jeffrey, who just says, Tigger is incredibly violent. He loves to torture his victims before killing them. So great little quote there. Thanks for that, Scott.
I wasn't expecting that. That's a curveball.
So, yeah, and again, like, all jokes aside, this has like an astronomical budget compared to the last film. Like, we're still talking about a micro budget horror film, but it's so much bigger, obviously, because that movie did unbelievably well. But the reason why I actually kind of put this in here was, as part of the news article, it says Matt Leslie wrote the screenplay for the sequel, and Matt Leslie was one of the main writers for Summer of 84. So I was like thinking about that film, and then I looked up the directors of that film, which is a trio of directors, and they've actually just done a new film. So the first one since Summer of 84. They also did Turbo Kid before that, which I've also seen. And their new movie is called We Are Zombies, which is currently doing the festival circuit. So it's like had its premiere at a couple of festivals only in the last couple of months. And so, yeah, that's one to look out for. Like, it sounds like a sort of horror comedy, but I haven't really looked it up too much. But I'm excited. Like, it's always cool. We discussed recently with, obviously, Stephen Kostanski finally returning. And, like, these indie guys, you know, it's very hard to find out news about them. So I always have to go out of my way to look for it. You genuinely, like, it's one of those things I need to search for the Life Changer director because I've not done that for a while. And you always have to remember these movies of like, oh, who directed Next Exit? Let's remember them. And, you know, the director of Lola. Like, I need to specifically look up these guys and see what they're doing.
And especially it's very cool. Because, like, they could, in those, like, 6 months or however long until you've looked, they could have, like, done nothing.
Yeah.
Like, literally for years. Or they might have put out three projects. Like, you just don't know in this indie world. Mm. But I have seen some people, like, or I've seen some, like, things about We Are Zombies. You know, it is more comedy.
Yeah.
Like, a comedy horror zombie movie.
Yeah, but something about, vegan zombies or non-cannibal zombies or something?
Yeah, I think they're non-cannibal zombies, and it's, like, this weird, like, group of friends that are trying to, I think they're trying to save their nun or something.
Yeah, it is that. Yeah, I read
like,
that.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that's what it was, and, like, it just felt, it sounds, like, very Shaun of the Dead, and, like, you know, it's about time that we had, like, a good homage come out to Shaun of the Dead like that, you know? So yeah, I remember seeing it and then like seeing it was at the festivals and thinking, oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, it's got those guys behind it. Yeah, definitely on the radar.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that'll get some sort of release. That'd be awesome if Shudder picked that one up. And lastly, another just small one, but this is again, awesome. But just October's mental. There's the new Hell House movie coming out in October. So yeah, this is the first prequel. Cause I think we just had the trilogy. We've covered the last two, done like individual shows on them. And obviously we've talked in depth about how great the first film was as well. It's called Hell House LLC Origins, The Carmichael Manor. And it's coming right at the end of the month, October 30th. And I think it is coming to Shudder because I think they do have it like all on there. So another awesome one. Shudder, you know, on fire this October. I think they've got probably one of their best ever lineups.
pretty good.
Which, yeah, we'll be getting to in the coming weeks. But yeah, I cannot wait to just to get into all of this great October. It's definitely one of those Octobers, like, was it last year or the year before, where it's basically our October ran through all of November and December, because there was so much cool shit to talk about. I remember, like, we got to Terrifier at, like, the end of November, because there was just so much shit to talk about. But yeah, very, very looking forward to that one as well. But yeah, that's it for the news this week. Shall we talk about this week's film?
Let's do it.
Let's talk about My Soul to Take. So yeah, like we said at the start, this is the final, I guess, new addition to the list, or at least in terms of his theatrical big film releases. May as well say it off the bat, really, instead of keep skirting around it. Like, obviously, he had TV films, Wes. In fact, he did 4 TV films, which, you know, may or may not be something that we'd like to include in the future. Because I actually looked up the first one, Summer of Fear, and that got, like, a Blu-ray release ridiculously recently.
A couple of them sounded decent.
Yeah, well, this one's fascinating because it came out in 78, so it was right off the bat of his first film, obviously Last House on the Left, so it's super early Wes. It got a theatrical release in Europe as well, which is crazy, and it stars Linda Blair, who was just coming off of The Exorcist, so, like, there's a lot about that that's, like, intriguing to me. But like I say, we'll leave that for another day, but for now, as part of our sort of what we set out to do when we started this, obviously beginning with the 4 Scream movies, this is the last of that list. Obviously, it was Wes's penultimate film that he did. This came out just 6 months before Scream 4, his final film, which is always fascinating. Like, there isn't really much in terms of behind the scenes. Like, I think most of this conversation will just be about the film. You know, there isn't, like,
The usual Wes problems, though, with this film.
In terms of, like, studio interference and stuff?
Well, interference, because I was reading that this movie got put in front of critics or screeners and the ending was kind of panned.
Right.
So this movie was then, you know, went back and they reshot, like, Christ, the last half an hour.
Right.
This is very much, like, different, because this is the last written and directed by Wes Craven.
Yeah,
and it's the very first rare one since kind of A New Nightmare.
I was going to say, like, that's something that he doesn't typically do. He's one of a few directors who's very much known for being just a director. Like, say, he did write stuff, and like you rightly said, this was the first one since New Nightmare with a 16-year gap. You know, so it's like, say, you know, all of the Scream movies, he was just a director, and it is fascinating, especially because a movie like this has so much Scream DNA over it, and we've discussed that time and time again, really, that he made so many films that were, like, kind of like Scream, but weren't. And, you know, there's, like, a whodunit element. It's, like, a mostly teen-centric film, you know, set in a high school. Like, it's very interesting how a lot of his other films, you know, was very similar to Scream.
I've got to be honest, like, this one feels a lot like Wes was thinking, can I pen a Scream movie? And kind of started to pen this slasher and be like, oh, okay, it's Woodsboro years later, and, you know, there's the soul of Billy Loomis has gone inside. Do you know what I mean? And then, like, he started to do it, and then kind of Kev Dog just, like, picked up the phone and was like, Wes got a banger idea for Scream 4. And Wes is like, oh, cool, Kev. Cool. Yeah, we'll do that. And then just kind of crossed out the working title and called it My Soul to Take.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, so this is a weird one in terms of, like, I think I've seen this film, but in terms of an actual watch, this may as well have been my first time watching it.
Nice.
Because there was, like, not a second of this that I could have remembered. Which literally, yeah, from the opening, which we'll get to, I was just like, what on earth is this film? But yeah, like, it's
the opening's wild.
Yeah, the opening is so crazy. But yeah, like, the way it takes form as a film, and then especially, like, the finale, which is a long finale set in, like, one place, that was so Scream to me. And kind of, like, these twists and turns, and it's really trying to make you think, like, oh no, who's really the bad guy and stuff. which we'll get to. And I guess, like, again, this hopefully people should know by now, but like our previous reviews of old films, there is like no spoiler warning or anything. We're just gonna spoil the shit out of this entire film, because it's very old, so people should have seen it by now. But do we do plots for these ones? I can't even remember.
Yeah, I tend to, especially when it's not like A Nightmare on Elm Street or something.
Yeah,
because I think there'll be a lot. I was going to say, I think there'll be a lot of people that you know won't have seen this movie. Mm. And like, side note, like it's weird because like horror movies around this time, you know, I'd say kind of, you know, the early 2000s to like, you know, this is what, 2010.
Yeah,
I think like. It's such a weird spell for horror where I feel like a lot of people feel like there's not classics there.
Mm.
And I literally at the weekend just went through all my old DVDs and was just like hunting them all out. And basically my DVD collection is just every movie that came out in like 2000 to 2010.
Yeah.
And I was just finding all, like, I remember like, you know, like The Ghost Ship and 13 Ghosts and...
like Creep and stuff like that.
House of Wax and but because those ones were all done by the same people, you know.
Yeah.
But then Creep and, you know, the Descent and Gothica and you know, Grudge and Ring and just all of these movies, the American ones, those two, and like just all of these kind of movies that came out around that time. And I'm like, I think almost all of them are just remembered by no one but me. And I have like this great like memory of like these, you know, because even stuff like Jeepers Creepers and that, like,
awesome.
You know, I just don't think that like they have this like level that people seem to remember them. And maybe they will, like maybe they just have to wait their time. But
it's an interesting you say that, because like that is the era that we first started watching new horror.
Yeah.
And so that is the one that we are so accustomed to. And I do think that there are great films, but I don't think it's necessarily looked at unfairly, because I do think that you look at like right now, so like the last 10 years, I do think is like unequivocally better than that 10-year period. But I would say it's definitely on par with like the 90s and stuff. And let's say when you want to look at, I mean, obviously like Saw was in there and Hostel and those like big films in you know around sort of 2004, but I do think there was, it was a weird time, because I think it was cinema horror wasn't the best. Because you had a lot of those, it was like that remake era, wasn't it? And granted, some of them are great, but I think a lot.
Yeah, they probably were. Yeah, like round about this time in particular was like huge remake time.
Yeah, you kind of had like Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, and then which was fantastic. And then it was like, God, there was so many. Like Wes had basically all of his films remade in like a 5-year period.
Yeah, I found all of those and in my collection at the weekend, and it upset me.
Yeah.
Because I even remember liking the Hills of Eyes remake a bit.
Oh man, and I loved that when I saw it at the cinema.
Like, just like seeing the cover art of it made me cringe. Like recently, like at the weekend, I was like, oh no, like I can't be doing this. I mean, let alone the sequel. But just the, you know, because I did like the remake when it first came out. But just thinking of it and all like the weird stuff at the end with the nuclear homes. I know we've gone off on a real tangent, but
is what these episodes are all about.
Yeah, like just getting those out and seeing all those DVDs, it really did remind me of that era, because that was like if a horror movie came out on DVD in like between 2000 and 2010, I was buying it.
Yeah.
And so it was weird to see that, you know, it was almost a time capsule of that period of horror movies.
Yeah, but it was also at a time where you probably could have seen pretty much everything, because it wasn't, there wasn't a huge breadth. Like I say, like cinema horror was rare, where, you know, outside of these big hits, I mean, you know, you get in a bit later to like Paranormal Activity and stuff. I know you're talking a little bit before that, but like there really wasn't in like Record, you know, like when you found these bangers, you really cherished them back then, because
I remember something, I think it came out a very similar time to this, like The Collector.
Yeah,
and being like, fuck yeah, like this is brilliant, we're gonna get a shit ton of these. And then like it took like years to get a sequel.
Yeah,
and then we just never got any more. Yeah, and
they're still in the process of making that new one. Like we've had it in the news multiple times.
Yeah, it's wild, you know. And yeah, like the Hostel movies and that sort of thing. But But yeah, and because do you remember like that I don't know whether it was a production company or whether it was the same team, but it was like
The Ghost
13
Ship
Ghosts,
yeah.
Ghost Ship, House on Haunted Hill, House of Wax.
I'll
Flags,
look it up now, yeah.
And like each year they're putting out these horror movies.
Yeah, you just said one of my favorites of that era, like 13 Ghosts. I fucking love
13
that
Ghosts
film.
Is sick, and House on Haunted Hill is incredible.
Yeah, oh yeah, that movie's scary as well. What is the it's a Dark Castle.
Yeah, but like, was it just Dark Castle or was it like a team? I thought
there was like Warner was involved in Columbia and stuff, but Dark Castle was kind of like the Blumhouse, as it were. Like they were the logo that you would see. Because so their first film was 99 House of a Thousand Corpses, House on Haunted Hill. And literally, so the first five they did was House on Haunted Hill, 13 Ghosts, Ghost Ship, Gothica, House of Wax.
Yeah, bangers.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible stuff.
But they're still good. They did like the Orphan movie last year.
yeah. It was just like that run. I remember just like each one and being like, oh, they've got another one. And because they were getting those licenses from like the old films.
Yeah.
But like just old films that I'd never seen. They were too old. And then just completely reimagining them.
Yeah, that's what's made. Like, I would love to see, because 13 Ghosts. There's a movie from 1960.
Yeah.
Which is like, obviously that's the year Psycho came out. Like, that'd be so crazy. I want to see just clips of that just to see what that looks like.
But yeah, it was a weird time, you know, like, and yeah, like, I've got a lot of love for those horror and yeah, it's hard to tell how good they actually are.
Well, another thing as well, like, again, this is, I know this is like a crazy tangent now talking about just this era, but like the Chucky sequels, like that was very much in the Bride of Chucky era, which we're a huge fan of, like.
Well, that's why, like, I think there's some real bangers there, and that's why, like, I think there's some real good ones, there's some good mid-tier, and then there's just the absolute trash that you can't help but like. Because, yeah, I just saw loads of slashers, like Valentine and stuff like that, where I'm like, oh, yeah, I like them, and, like, you know, I know what he did last summer and stuff, and it's like, yeah.
Well, I just inadvertently said it, but, like, House of a Thousand Corpses was around that time as well.
Yeah,
like,
exactly, you know. Yeah, it was a weird time, and it was, like I said, it was funny to just open this DVD capsule of just every single one of those movies.
Yeah, and this is definitely one of them. Like, I remember this when this film came out.
Yeah.
Which, again, is why I have such a weird memory of it. Like, I remember
this was in there.
Yeah, like, because it was,
DVD,
I remember being
like the weekend.
Yeah, so Scream 4 was one that I was very excited for. And I remember going to the cinema and seeing that and having a blast, because it was the first Scream I saw at the cinema. And, you know, that was very much like an active participation in that. Like, I remember the trailer coming out. I remember I was at university at the time, and I remember showing people the trailer for Scream 4 and being like, look how fucking sick this looks, and going to watch it. Whereas, yeah, My Soul to Take comes out just a bit before, and it was like, I think I heard about this because you showed me the DVD like physically. You were like, look at this, and I was like, that's weird. And he's like, you know who directed it? Like, Wes Craven. I was like, what? Like, what is this?
He had a movie coming out in like a week. Like,
yeah,
what?
I was like,
why?
You can't make two at once.
Yeah, it was wild. But yeah, I guess kind of slowly going back to the movie in question, My Soul to Take. Basically the movie opens, and we'll talk about the open with like the end of a serial killer's run, and kind of him being taken down by police, maybe eventually. And then kind of cut to 16 years later, and the town every year remembers the killer, but also the weird phenomenon that happened, that multiple women went into labor the night that the killer died, and seven babies were born on the same day that the killer died. And we're now 16 years later, and the killings are starting again. And it seems that either the killer or killers is reenacting the Ripper's kind of kills, or is the Ripper himself, or is one of the seven, or is just trying to kill all of the seven. And it's this weird slasher that is kind of centered around these seven kids and kind of the people going after him. And again, like, that's a massive pull on Nightmare on Elm Street right there. Like, as I was talking about it, I was like, well, that's literally the plot of Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, Freddy comes back and kills the children of the parents that wronged him.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah, it is weird how it is this pull from a lot of like Wes's history. You know, it's very screamy, it's very Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, and in this weird kind of slasher where it just it feels to me like this movie was made because Wes didn't really know that he was going to make a Scream 4.
Yeah,
because at the time, I remember like thinking to myself, oh, this was him like getting back into the helm and being like, oh, I've got Scream 4. I'm going to bash out a horror beforehand. And like, but now like looking at it and knowing that, he penned this, it was like, no, I think he was like, oh, I want to make another slasher and I want to make a Scream movie. And like I say, whether this was originally set to be a Scream movie or not, like it definitely feels like this was Wes scratching that itch. And then suddenly Scream 4 did come along.
Yeah, that's how I read it. Like, watching this, and again, not really knowing too much, like, I was astounded how you just swap a few things, and it really does follow so many of the formula of previous Scream films.
Yeah.
Aside from, like you say, the biggest turning or biggest sort of difference, which I think is worth mentioning because it is something that is so important to the film and, like, why the title makes sense and everything, is, like, yeah, this serial killer in the opening is kind of like a soul. Like, it's a guy who has, what, multiple identity disorder, or dissociative, where he's, like, not aware he has another identity. But it's not just him. It seems like it's, like, an identity like a soul that can kind of sort of travel between different people at different times. So, like, this guy that you see in the opening, he's like not Shocker. Aware. Exactly. Yeah, well, Shocker is... So, like, I need to just get into this opening, because this opening 10 minutes is so insane. Like... I had to just take a breath after watching it because I was like, oh my God, if this is going to be what the rest of the film is, I've just found the sequel to Shocker that I never knew existed. Because it was that exact vibe. It was unbelievable. Like, not the opening to Shocker, because that's what's so funny. It's almost like the inverse, because Shocker starts out really serious.
Yeah.
And it's just about a dude killing people. And then it's not until he actually survives the electric chair, and then that's when it goes mental. Whereas this movie, within 30 seconds, it's comedic vibe. It's like people doing, you know, very cheesy over the top acting from this family man who's like possessed by this killer, these like insane one-liners, and it's like a one-liner followed by another one-liner followed by another one-liner, and it's like, you think this person's dead, now they jumped up for that final jump scare like you get at the end of every Scream movie.
Yeah, like the killer does that. A jump scare, the cop does a jump scare, then
they
the
do
it
like four
another
times
cop does a jump scare then
in
then
the same scene.
Yeah,
yeah, and after each one of those fake outs, there's a cheesy one-liner that accompanies it. So it's very much like a, you should have killed him when you had the chance, and that's the liner, and then someone jumping up and be like, I will this time, and then another person jumps
here's
up and is like, no
chance, motherfucker.
Yeah, like it's crazy, where I was like, this film is mental. Like, the first 10 minutes and the way it all transpires in the ambulance. Like, I always love when a film, especially a horror film, starts like most films end. I always think that's cool, because normally you have to wait until the end of a film to get like a crazy standoff in an ambulance and stuff like that. So just to open the movie with that is so cool, I think. You know, like, he's going crazy, and then like the fact that this thing flips and sets on fire, and there's this level of ambiguity because you don't actually see him die. I was like, holy shit, like, this opening is mental. And then the movie obviously shifts to where the rest of the film takes place 16 years later. And there is still moments where it's zany and quite silly, but I think for the most part, that's not the tone. Again, there's a lot in it that I think is funny, and certain deliveries of certain characters. Like, there's so many just characters popping up out of nowhere and, like, shouting. Just feels so comedic. And again, it's very hard to tell. Like a lot of Wes's films, I almost love it in so many ways, because he's such an enigma.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, we love Wes Craven so much. We've now seen all of his films, and discussed them in depth. But like, I still struggle at times to fully get the tone that he's going for.
Yeah.
I don't
understand
a movie like
him
this,
as a filmmaker, like, at times, like, you know,
yeah,
you can watch, like, we've watched all of his movies, and it isn't like, oh, this is definitely a Wes movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, there are so many directors that have an obvious tone that they stick to, and you know, mostly for better. It's like a Rob Zombie film is a prime example. Yeah. Like, you know, aside from him making something slightly different last time around, it's a Rob Zombie film for the most part, and we love it for that. Whereas, yeah, Wes does so many, like, we've said before, he spent a lot of his career, it seemed like, trying to break out of the mold that he got put in, and then at times he's then more comfortable stepping back into that mold with like, the Scream movies. But then something like Vampire in Brooklyn that we discussed, where he's trying to make a comedy, you've then got a comedic actor in Eddie Murphy trying to make a serious vampire movie, and it's just like, what is going on here? And I feel like other people have struggled with Wes and his tone, because he does want to make weird shit. Like, I think that's his biggest takeaway, is that he never just wanted to make the same film over and over again. I think that's why, yes, we have compared this to Scream a couple of times, but I think tonally it's so different. It's only in terms of, like, ticking boxes and, like, you know, the whodunit and stuff like that, but, like, there isn't a Scream movie that he made, or anyone else has made for that matter, that has a tone like this film.
No.
And like you say, it has that weird shocker vibe, and then it gets a bit more serious sort of 16 years later.
Yeah,
but, like, I was very confused at this point and excited for what's to come at that point. What did you make, I guess, of the open? I guess obviously you're how familiar with you with this film? Yeah, I know you've seen it, but it must have been a while ago.
It was a while ago. Yeah, like, as soon as it started, and I was like the opening scene kind of ended, and I kind of forgot how, like, over the top that was, definitely. But as soon as it kind of started again, like, I remembered, like, a few things. Like, I remembered the whole Fang being his sister. Like, like, early on when we saw her, and I was like, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure she's not a mean girl by the end of it. I'm pretty sure she's his sister. And then, like, instantly I remembered who the killer was.
Right.
But I didn't...
I have some questions about that, which we can get to.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't... But there were things along the way that definitely I didn't... and remember, and one of the big things was, like, the pacing of, like, people dying, because I had, like I said, I remembered kind of those bits, like, a bit, but there were certain characters, like, I think it was Penelope was, like, the kind of religious slash love interest, where I was like, man, I can't believe she got wiped out so quick. And then, like, The jock guy and Brittany got wiped out in the same scene.
That was so
shocking
to me.
Yeah, and it was like, we got to, like, probably about, I don't know, 50 minutes into this movie that's like an hour and 50, and, like, 4 of the 7 were dead.
Mm.
Like, to the point that, like, we get to the point pretty, like, about 40 minutes left of the movie where it's kind of, like, down to 2 people.
Yeah.
And then it's
a very long finale.
Yeah, and I definitely found, like, I really enjoyed the opening. I enjoyed, like, getting to the finale, and then by the end of the finale, I enjoyed it. But there were definitely parts of it where I was like, fucking hell, I can't believe these two dudes are just chatting again. And, like, they had a little chat. They naff off. He gets stabbed, like, 4 times. He comes back now all stabbed, and he's like, oh, you've got a bit of blood on your head. And he's like, yeah, you've been stabbed, like, 4 times, bro. And then they have this, the second time they have an awkward, like, well, I could be the killer, but, you know, why would I be? And then he's like, well, you know, I might be the killer, but not really. And it was like this, it was this weird, like, just over embellished kind of conversation between those two. Like, I think that whole finale was really good, apart from the two long scenes of those two talking, because
they really wanted to keep you in anticipation. Yeah. Didn't they? Like, God, they wanted you to not know who it was until the last second.
Yeah. And it was kind of ridiculous. And it was one where I was like, where did Fang go? How long does it take her to get police?
Oh, that's hilarious. Is she just sitting in the car for, like, the whole time?
Yeah, just, like, chilling, just, like, you know. And
even what happens to, oh, God, what's his name, the blind guy? Is it Jerome?
Yeah.
He just, like, the way he appears in the finale is so bizarre.
I'm like, dude, how did you get in there?
Yeah, well, because what happens, again, this is weird, where... is it Bug is fighting what seemingly is the Ripper.
Yeah.
And then there's just like a loud noise off screen and the Ripper just fucks off.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I must go investigate this noise. Which I'm assuming is that Jerome coming into the house?
I think it's him, like, I think he said, didn't he, Jerome, that, like,
he fell into the house or whatever.
Yeah, because he got stabbed on, like, the roof trying to get into the house.
Yeah, so that happened pre the other fight.
I'm not, like, I don't want to laugh because of, like, his disability, but just the idea of him being, like,
on this guy's rooftop,
stabbed, unconscious, and then waking up, like, this blind person that's been stabbed, that's unconscious on a roof. Like, and somehow he makes it into the building, and then, like...
this is Daredevil's origin story.
Yeah, and then he hits his knee on a dresser and makes a noise. I'm like, motherfucker, how did you not make a noise until that point?
Is that what he said, the noise was him coming in, and then does he hide in the closet in anticipation? So when the Ripper buggers off upstairs, he doesn't have a confrontation with Jerome at that point.
Jerome was slowly bleeding to death. Hidden,
Right, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that I, again, we're jumping all over the shop, but like I had a really good time with this movie.
Mm.
But definitely the finale is where I just had like questions, where I was like, this is, again, it starts with a tone, which I loved, which then it doesn't throw away, but it's not fully that tone for the rest of the movie. We then get a bunch of cool scenes. Like I love the scene with Bug and, is it Brandon? Is that his friend? Mm. Doing like the condor bit in the classroom. I loved all that and kind of like the bit with the bully and everything. That was great. Then like the spying on the girls in the bathroom was great. Like I loved all the hijinks like in the school. It was fantastic. Then getting to like actually the Ripper killing people, I thought pretty much they were all great. Again, like a lot of films of this era, it relies, or it doesn't rely on, but it has the mix of cool practical effects and then just like stupid visual effects that the movie just doesn't need, particularly in the blood, where it's like it has good fake blood that you see, but then they just for some reason add digital blood that just looks terrible. So that is off-putting, but it's very much just, it's a 2010 film. Like it just stands out like a sore thumb of this era. And then like I say, once it was getting to the finale in the house, I was on board. I didn't know where it was going. The kind of the reveal of the sister, like you say, when you get the opening, and I was a bit confused because we obviously see the daughter of the Ripper in the opening scene. So I was aware of that, of like, okay, this is going to be someone. But then throughout the whole film, they are making it seem like Bug is the one who obviously has the attachment to the Ripper, which obviously gets explained later on. But like that did confuse me because I was going through a whole different range of emotions where I was like, was that not a girl in the opening scene? Yeah, or is there some other weird thing with Bug now? Like I was going through so many things to make it more complicated than it was, because I was like, well, who is the connection to this little girl? So that I didn't ever really suspect it was Fang. So like when that's reveal, which is done in such a casual way of her just walking down the stairs and insulting him,
hey,
I was like, I was just like, oh wait, you guys live in the same house, oh wait, that's your sister, like, and now she's being called Leia, like, you know, the name of the girl in the opening scene. Like it's, I thought that was all really well done. And getting the confrontation with the mom and finding out the history, but then it was, it's not even that it was bad, it was just it went on a bit too long. Like say the fake carrots between the two of them, Bug and Brandon, I was getting to the point where I was like, I almost don't care who it is at this point, because it's like, well, it's one of you and you've both done enough mad shit at this point that I don't really care who it is. But I still enjoyed it by the end. The question I want to just get to with in terms of that, because I was a bit confused, is like, so throughout this film, we're talking about souls and, you know, when the people are getting killed, like the souls are going into Bug, because he's like when the guy on the bridge dies early on, he then becomes creative because apparently that guy was creative. And like, I love this weird element that Wes put in this film that, again, isn't fully, you know, it's not fully realized, but it's there and it's interesting.
At one point, souls are having conversations with him where he's like, oh,
yeah.
Thingy's putting the timeline together now to see whether you could be the killer. Brittany, he's like, Brittany's putting the timeline together to see whether you could do all these murders. And I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, they're all looking in his head talking to him.
Yeah, which is, again, is bizarre. So, yeah, the question I had was, obviously, you get the reveal that, like, Brandon, I guess, has the soul of the Ripper in him at that point. So
was he the killer Brandon, for the whole movie?
Yeah, was Brandon the killer in the whole? I guess it's a two-part question. But let's start with that. Like, was Brandon the killer the whole time? Do you know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer to it.
Right. Is it left open? Would you say, or do you think we just don't understand it?
I don't know. Like, I kind of feel like it's left open because I feel like he easily could have been. But I think that we could have easily been in a world where, like, yeah, Brittany, you know, Brittany killed Penelope and then Brandon killed Brittany and you know.
Oh, they're like all doing it, right, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, even that Bug was, like, involved even, like, you know, because there are multiple scenes where Bug, like, freaks out with a knife and shit and, like,
yeah,
you know, he has images of memory of him dragging Brittany's body.
Yeah.
And like, and then when he's got his cake and he's eating his birthday cake and or blown out the candles, he's covered in mud. So I'm like, I think it's open ended, but I could easily, you know, like I say, I think that Bug could have easily committed some of these murders. And then actually, I don't know, man. Like, the more I think about it, because when we got that monologue right at the end, and he's like, "I'm not the hero. Like, I don't want to be the hero, but I'm going to fake it for Brandon." Like, part of me does wonder, like, how much of the film Bug was the killer.
That's how I read it. Like, especially because he's consuming the souls of the people, which that was, like, I think that was the gimmick of the Ripper, was, like, that's why he was doing it sort of thing. So, in my eyes, Bug was killing the people. And then, like, in the finale at some point, the Ripper soul went from Bug to Brandon, and then he kills Brandon, like, to kill the Ripper sort of thing. So that was confusing to me. The other question I had was, like, when his sister says about how he, like, killed people in the past, do you know, like, what she's referring to? Because they talk about him being in, like, a institution or something.
Yeah, well, I think, again, like, it's not cleared up. And I think it talks a lot, you know, it goes a lot to what I kind of seen when I'd look into the making of this a bit, that, like, there was a lot of reshoots. Because there is I did see that there was, like, a deleted scene that she talks about that again, to say that he's been in a mental institution and stuff in front of the mum, or, you know, the auntie.
Yeah, because she's, like, hiding it, isn't she? She keeps, like, not wanting him to find out about his past or whatever.
And, yeah, like, it seems very much that, like, I do wonder if this is the classic Wes movie where what we've discussed and, like, Bug being the killer and, like, the killer being multiple people and everything else didn't test well. And that's why it was kind of stripped away and was like, oh, yeah, it's probably just Brandon. And, like, and then the reshoots kind of just did it to, like, put that in. And because, like I say, the stuff that's in there where Bug is, like, literally having memory of dragging the bodies and, like, is covered in mud, like, you know, just doesn't get explained. Like, either he did it or he can just see through the killer's eyes.
Yeah, like, did he just have the soul of whoever the killer was in that moment now inside him? Like, it is, once you're dealing with what this film is about, it's easy to open it up to interpretation, because like I say, it could be any of these scenarios, because it's obviously it's very supernatural. Like, we're talking about souls jumping into people, and even like the ending of, so why does Bug stabbing Brandon and then Brandon's last moments when he's alive be him as a real person back to normal Brandon? Why does that suddenly kill the Ripper's soul? Like, surely that just went back into Bug at that point, or his sister.
Yeah,
like, I mean, there was plenty of people around that he could have moved into.
I think that's the problem, like, because I don't think this movie is very well received.
No,
and I think that's, you know, when you start to break it down with that, like, there are a lot of this, you know, this movie's called My Soul to Take, eventually. And when you look at, you know, all of the soul stuff and what that means and who the killer is, these questions, you know, the last few minutes we've been talking about, it's muddy and it's messy.
Yeah.
And it screams that the reshoot might have caused that issue. But either way, I think it just shows that, like, that, you know, and I think that's why a lot of people this doesn't sit that well with. But for me, ultimately, like, I just have a good time with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, like, the overall reception, because it was one that I was definitely aware of going into this, where, like, that was one of the few things I remembered where people were like, oh, it's, you know, it's terrible.
Yeah, it's
so I was expecting, like, a stinker, and we have seen some stinkers. And for me, this is far from that. Like I say, I have some problems in understanding some of the weird aspects of the lore and the background of what's actually going on. Like, I think, again, it has that problem of not fully establishing what the rules are in this world. And it's why something like Nightmare on Elm Street is so bulletproof as a film, because I don't think any point when I've ever watched that original film I ever had any questions about, like, understanding what was going on. And again, that's like a mad concept when you're dealing with it, you know. It's another supernatural thing. It's not like Scream, that it's just a guy with a knife. Like, it's mental and bizarre, but it's so easy to comprehend because the story's told so well. And this clearly isn't that, but I still think that this is super entertaining, really well acted. I thought, like, I think everyone is pretty good in the cast throughout. Again, for a young cast, like, I really liked Bug and Brandon and pretty much everyone, like all the girls and everything. They were all great. And yeah, like, I still think whilst the ending was slightly long and a bit confusing, I'm glad I saw this. And it's definitely, it's not, it's clearly not one of his best films, but it's definitely not one of his worst.
No, this is a mid-tier Wes, definitely.
But yeah, is that, are we ready to rank it, or do we have anything else to say? I think that's
probably a good, you know, we're already starting to get into that wheelhouse, so it seems like a good time to jump into it.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, we'll probably go over the full list at the end, but, I mean, this isn't going to be, you know, top, shall we say. We're getting into, like, mid of the list is kind of like Last House on the Left of Scream 3 to People Under the Stairs, and then you've got, like, the bottom tier, which is like Deadly Blessing, Deadly Friend, Vampire in Brooklyn, and Serpent in the Rainbow.
Yeah, so like I think it's comfortably better than those last ones you said, and then I think we just work up from there.
Yeah, I agree. Those bottom four, it's this better than them. So then going from, so 12, 13, and 14 is The People Under the Stairs, Cursed, and Swamp Thing. And I guess above that is Scream 3, but it's clearly not anywhere near that. Yeah. So I would say, yeah, it's somewhere in there. Like, it's difficult.
Say those ones again.
So People Under the Stairs, the highest at 12, then Cursed, and then Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking about four vastly different films.
Like, I think I enjoyed this more than Swamp Thing.
And then, I think I did as well.
And then it's like, man, Cursed, People Under the Stairs, and this are incredibly close for me.
Yeah,
like, in terms of, like, they're just like good movies. They have their faults, they have their highs, they have their lows. You know, Cursed had some crazy highs and lows, you know, this did the same. And I think People Under the Stairs is probably like the most consistently good movie of them all, but doesn't have the highs.
Yeah,
I think there are better moments than the other two. The other thing, just to touch upon, this movie, like, I just popped into my head. This was in the era of, we spoke about the remakes, but this got the curse of the other thing that was around that time, the 3D-ism.
Yeah, the 3D post-conversion, which was terrible.
Which is just bath. Yeah, like, just so awful. I'm so glad that, like, we're beyond that now.
Yeah.
Now that was one of the main reasons. And you don't do it.
Yeah, and like, and he does it properly as well. Like, say, this is a post-conversion. This was never shot in 3D. This was never conceptualized in 3D. It came out at a time during the 3D boom post-Avatar. And so they decided to put it in 3D screenings, which is one of the reasons why it bombed, because it got put into so many of the special 3D screenings and nobody wanted to see it. But yeah, it's in terms of the list, you know, looking at, I guess, we're right now just looking at People Under the Stairs and Cursed. Yeah. Like, for me, The People Under the Stairs is one of the hardest movies to figure out my own opinion on, because I know, again, this is our list, and it will always just be our list, and it's just our favorites. It's not talking about, you know, we're not trying to rate this in any sort of critical aspect. It's just what do we prefer. But I'm aware that that's the one that we clearly like less than most people. So I always, it's hard for me to fully judge it, because I think People on the Stairs is good. I just know everyone else thinks it's so much better than we think it is.
Yeah.
So that's like the only, that's a difficult one for me, where I'm like, and Cursed was fun. I'm trying, it's very similar to Cursed, actually. I'm trying to think just which movie I had more fun with. And I don't, it's hard because I got recency bias. So, like, I'm thinking about this movie a lot more, and I'm already struggling to think about Cursed.
I know, that's exactly where I'm at. But I do, like, I do just think that this one speaks probably a little bit more to my tastes.
You know, yeah, I think it does for me as well.
With it being
Cursed had more, like, potential, didn't it? Of, like, being Wes's take on a werewolf film, it's so disappointing what it ended up being.
I think that's the thing, that, like, I come out of this movie with not a huge amount of disappointment. I come out of this movie thinking, like, oh, it was a fun slasher, I had a good time, and he probably needed to just get that plot down a bit more, you know, explain to me the whole soul thing, and was it the one killer or multiple or whatever, and not leave me as confused on that. Whereas coming out of Cursed, we were like, fuck, he had the creature design, he had the script, he had everything, and he just got fucked so badly. And in
he
the
had
end,
a film at one point.
he had a film at one point, and like, we never get to see that, and like that. So like, my overwhelming like post Cursed like feeling is like of disappointment, as opposed to like this, where I'm like, oh yeah, no, this was just like fun.
I also think for me, the Cursed is in that bracket of, we have the bad Wes films, and then we have a small portion of kind of like, oh, they're not what they could have been. And then you then get from like pretty much People on the Stairs, to be honest, like the top 12 is like, these are just great Wes films. So I do like the fact that these two, to me, make perfect sense that they're going to be touching in the list. Like I said, I think that it's clearly going to be below People on the Stairs, it's just which one above the other. But yeah, I would lean towards more My Soul to Take, because I think it was closer to what he was going for. Like, it's pretty much there. I would say this is probably 80% the way there.
Definitely.
Whereas Cursed is nowhere near that close. So yeah, are we in agreement then that My Soul to Take is the new number 13? So yeah, that's it now. So 19 of his again, that he did, I guess.
What
was it called? There was a movie he did that's just not a horror film. I can't remember what it's called now. Something of the Heart, like Rhythm of the Heart or something.
No.
God. Music of the Heart? Is that what it is?
Oh, God.
You can look that up, because I need to read 19 films.
Something, isn't it? Something Paris.
Oh, there's two.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You can potentially look that up if you'd like, because I have a lot of reason to do here. So we have our ranking.
We're going to start from the bottom
yeah, let's do it. Yeah, we don't do the whole list, but seeing as this is the kind of for the finale, for the most point, there might be an epilogue to it, but this is the list. Because I really want to see this other film now that I've discovered it. But this was what we set out to do initially, which is, again, we can always add to it if we want. But yeah, number 19, the worst, our least favorite Wes Craven film at number 19 is The Serpent and the Rainbow, which... I mean, we'd have to analyze all these, but like, I'm glad that's last, because I struggle to remember anything about, like, even going up to the next film, which was Vampire in Brooklyn, I can remember a couple of good scenes in that, and going forward, it'll only get better. I don't remember anything of merit in that film.
Well, the thing that made me laugh is that I just remember with Vampire in Brooklyn that I really didn't like that movie. So the fact that I like Serpent and the Rainbow less.
Yeah, it was
a mess.
No question. Really bad. So yeah, 18, Vampire in Brooklyn. 17, Deadly Friend. 16, Deadly Blessing. We never could break up those two deadly films. They were always destined to be touching in this list.
Yeah, I mean, I still don't know the difference between the two. Like,
yeah. Deadly Friend's the wacky sci-fi one with the robot.
Deadly Friend is the one that probably has been shafted and should be much higher on the list.
You need to watch Deadly Friend.
That's the greatest explosion ever.
Deadly Blessing, I actually would say what you just said in terms of, because I think there's a really interesting and cohesive story in that, and it's really well, like, really good cinematography and really well acted. It's just kind of boring. But there's so much in that that's clearly, you know, made its way into Nightmare on Elm Street, which is so cool. But yeah, moving on to number 15, Swamp Thing. Number 14, Cursed. The new number 13, My Soul to Take. Number 12, The People Under the Stairs. Then we really get into some big heavy hitters. The first Scream movie, our least favorite of Wes's Scream movies, is number 11, Scream 3. Then number 10, his debut film, The Last House on the Left. Nice to see it in the top half of the list.
Yeah, and I think that one is such a weird, you know, it's such a weird movie because it's so unsettling. That, like, I would watch so many more of the movies further down the list multiple times before I watch that movie again. But you can't change what it is, you know, and how gnarly it is. Just, it's not something that you can just watch.
Again, it's funny. It's almost like we made this list, but like, I'm so happy that it's right bang in the middle because I think that's the perfect way to describe that film. Like, it really is. I think it's awesome and it's so cool that it kicked off his career with such a classic. I don't know when I'll ever rewatch that, but then it's funny that the movie below that, our least favorite Scream film, I've seen infinitely more times and will continue to see Scream 4 more times than I ever see Last House on the Left.
Well, I think as well, it's funny that like you say, even though this is our list, this is the first time I'm hearing and like it all together, do you know what I mean? The fact that that is number 10 in his top 10 is perfect. Like that is the perfect number for that to be. Like, in my head, that's where it should be, and I'm so glad that, like, you know, if you just say, yeah, what are the top 10 Wes Craven movies, I'd be like, right, let's start off with Last House and then go from there. Like, so it really has worked out perfect.
Yeah, like, I don't think we need to, because I think we're both very happy with this, and obviously we've done this now over years, but, like, we've always had we could have switched things out on a whim whenever we wanted to.
Well, I think that's the thing. If Last House wasn't in the top 10, I would have probably been like, I think it needs to get in the top 10 somehow. And so the fact that it's 10 is perfect.
Yeah, if that would have crept down to like 12 or something, it just would have thought right.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, I agree. And then we just get into stuff that's, you know, we get into the best of his films, or we get into ones that are just such our favorites. I love that number 9, probably the biggest surprise for me in this whole list, is Shocker. Obviously, it's the highest rated film that I'd never seen before. So that was the one that was a real joy to me, and one that I've only seen once. So I cannot wait to rewatch that in the future. Number 8 was Wes Craven's New Nightmare. Number 7, which is, God, this just shows you the quality of this list, man. Number 7 is Scream 2. Like, in my opinion, one of the greatest horror sequels of all time. And it's number 7. Crazy. Number 6.
The opening of that.
Oh,
like,
God.
Introducing the Stab franchise. Mm-hmm. Like, in the cinema with the double murder like that. Like, one of the best openings of a sequel ever. Like, and like I say, just opening this world up of Stab, which is just like, you know, what elevated the Scream movies to a whole new level.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I think this was the one that we probably debated a lot in terms of Scream 2, because we both love Scream 2 so much, but it's very difficult when you're dealing with clearly our third favorite Scream film. So it is difficult, because especially going to number 6, which is The Hills Have Eyes, which again is an absolute classic, an absolute banger. One of the reasons, like one of the franchises why we fell in love with Wes. But on most days, I probably would prefer to watch Scream 2. So it's a difficult one. But nevertheless, definitely valid. And then we get into our top 5. God, these movies are just sensational. I mean, these 5 are, you know, some of our favorite movies of all time. Like, this 5 alone, like, is why Wes is our favorite director.
You know, if I was to say my top 5 horror movies of all time, like, if I was to give a top 10, like, you know, these would probably mostly be in there.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, number 5 is Red Eye, which obviously we finally got to discuss this year. Yeah. Just, God, I've loved that movie from the second we saw it at the cinema when it came out. It's so, so good.
Yeah, and it's love of Cillian Murphy as well that's like, and his career, that like, I will continue to seek him out because of his performance solely in Red Eye.
Yeah, I'm so glad we got to talk about Red Eye this year, because, you know, he's been around for so long, but there's no question, absolutely no question, that this is his biggest year of all time. You know, he is the lead in one of the biggest films of the year, and I hope he has a lot of recognition coming his way early next year. Then into number 4, our beloved, and the one that is the story of basically why this podcast exists, is The Hills Have Eyes Part 2. Sensational. Yeah. So happy that it still stayed that high. Fully deserved. If anyone's like, what? You need to go listen to our episode on that film. Because I think we did a good job of it.
Probably should be higher.
It probably should, to be honest. Like, I feel that way about all these films at this point.
Yeah.
Like, because I remember I was pushing for Red Eye to be higher at the time. Like, it's just difficult.
And again, at the weekend, sorting out all my old storage boxes, and found The Hills Have Eyes Part 2 VHS tape. which I will always, I decided to get rid of the video player because I'm like, that's just stupid. I'm never putting the video in and actually watching it. But
I'd be too worried to get destroyed.
Exactly. But I'm like, I'm clearly still going to keep the video.
Like, yeah, that needs to be encased, like in a special case to keep it perfect.
Yeah. Well, when you know, years gone by, when, you know, when the show inevitably ends and the fans kind of, you know, start creating shrines and everything else, then we will donate this video to the fan with the biggest shrine.
Oh, hell no. That's not going anywhere. Like, I'm top of that list if you're never owning it, that's for sure. But yeah, that's number four. Number three, now we're getting into the big ones. Of course, number three is Scream 4. In my opinion, you know, the best sequel to Scream. An amazing franchise.
In our six, opinion.
Yeah, like, you know, six fantastic entries. Mm. One of the best this year and one of the best horror films of this year was the newest Scream. And it's why it's, I mean, it's probably the best franchise, to be honest. Like, six undoubtedly fantastic ones. But when you're the best of, I mean, you're talking Scream 2, Scream 6. Like, these are amazing films. But Scream 4 is so, so special. And I think the reason why is because it has my favorite killers aside from the first film. Like, I adore that reveal and everything. I've been a lifelong Emma Roberts fan because of that film. And will always get excited to see her and stuff just because it always reminds you of that amazing star making performance in Scream 4. It's such
like
a,
we said
a joy.
With Cillian Murphy, you know, yeah. it's the same thing with
it really
know, Scream
is.
4 was what really got us on the Emma Roberts train as well, and like her performance and that, we will just continue to seek her out, you know, for a lifetime.
Exactly. And then, yeah, we then get to number two. They're crazy that there has to be a number two. And it's much debated, even between ourselves to this day. And I honestly feel like we'll never have a definitive one because it's almost like the impossible question, really, of like when you put Scream against Nightmare on Elm Street. I don't ever want to have to judge them that way because they're both perfection.
I can't do it. And like, yeah, I almost don't want you to say like two and one because in my mind I'm like it's almost indistinguishable because they're both so seminal. And it is wild that like they're, you know, especially when you think of films that are that good but also shaped us as a horror fan that much. Name another movie that would cause as much of a headache as these two going up against each other. Like just out, you know, like outside of Wes, it's like I don't think there is one.
No, certainly not. Because in my opinion, on any given day, I would say either of these are the greatest horror film ever made.
Yeah, it would be something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something that would cause us this amount of headache. You know, like it would need to be something like crazy. But even then, when it's a Super Horror Bros list, like what these two movies did to shape us, and so that's why, yeah, it's so hard to distinguish.
It is, but like we had to put a two next to one of them, which we ended up giving to Scream, which I almost feel like the caveat is just because there's a lot of Scream. and granted, of course, there's a lot of Nightmare. There's only two on the list because he only directed two of them. And I think that is probably the distinguishing factor. But it's weird because like the one thing I will say is Scream is clearly the superior franchise, in my opinion. Because it just has six that I would watch on any given day. Whereas I've spoke in length and like I love A Nightmare on Elm Street, our number one film, of course. And but I do think that it doesn't get the credit it deserves because of the franchise it exists in. And it sounds like such a diss, but it's not supposed to be that way. Because I say the exact same thing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And it's weird because like I don't think Psycho has this problem at all. Yeah, Hellraiser does as well. But it's weird how like Psycho has a bunch of shit.
It should be standalone. Tools.
Yeah, and it's like, but it's like, oh yeah, but it's Hitchcock's one, and it's like, well, it should be the same way. Again, I know Wes made another one; it's on our list. We love New Nightmare.
I was going to say, put New Nightmare in the conversation then, because it's also a banger. You know, if Wes had made four or five Nightmare on Elm Street movies, it could have been such a different story.
But I think the other thing as well is because Freddy became such a pop icon because it's the same actor in all those films. Again, Robert Englund as Freddy, I can watch that in a terrible film. It's so entertaining. But what the performance, how scary it is. Yeah, like that movie, again, I don't think it gets the credit it deserves, where it would be nailed on. Like, so many of these other films are nailed on, whereas I think with that, people sometimes will go, oh, yeah, they'll think of some of the goofier stuff with Freddy and think of him more as, like, a comedic one-liner.
Yeah, not in
but
that.
You just have to judge that one film. Try to block out everything else and just judge that one film on its own. It's impeccable. Like, there is no doubt in my mind how special that film is.
I think as well, like, obviously you talk about how special that the film is, like, critically, you know, with these two. But I think as well, the reason why that got the nod above Scream is because it was the genesis of a lot of things, you know, for us, you know. And in particular for me, I think, like, Freddy has always been my guy. And, like, I've loved him from such a young age. And, like, I was aware that the dude that did Freddy had made these movies called Scream. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would have come across Scream, but I don't think I would have seen him when I saw them. Which, and when we saw those Scream movies, were perfect, because it was when, like, the sequels were then coming out and stuff. And so, like, just all of that time, and it was the house that Freddy built, like the Wes Craven filmography, us following him. And so, you know, and I think that's why, is like, you know, Freddy as a character, and that movie is just so incredibly important to our love of Wes, our love of horror, and everything.
Also, like, I guess, well, without Nightmare on Elm Street, do we not get the greatest film trilogy of all time?
I'm scared now.
Like, technically, if a Nightmare on Elm Street didn't exist, do we maybe not get the Lord of the Rings?
No, we don't. We don't.
Well, I mean, to me, that alone...
It's the house that Freddy built, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. Like, to me, that's the decider. Like...
Yeah, so, I've had this argument with people. I genuinely...
Because that's how... The thing is, that's how ridiculous you have to get in this argument, because you can't talk about the films, because the films are impeccable. And there's no, you can't say, if someone says to me, Scream's the greatest horror film of all time, I'm going to go, yep, that's my argument. Yeah. I go, uh-huh. Yeah, like, I'm not going to ever debate that. Yeah. Whereas with this, it's like, yeah, I can at least go into some ridiculous reason of, like, well, technically, even though it's got nothing to do with horror, in my opinion, the greatest film trilogy of all time maybe wouldn't exist without Nightmare on Elm Street. Ooh. So... There you go. But yeah, that is it for now, after 3.5 years.
Where's Craven's number one movie, The Lord of the Rings trilogy? It's taken us 3.5 years to come to that fucking conclusion.
Oh my God, that's so good. Oh, this was all worth it. Oh my God, that was the best thing I've heard all year. That was amazing. It's so true. Oh dear.
Sorry, guys. I'm sorry. I do love you, really.
No, he gets credit, man. Like, yeah, he's the main guy. Yeah. It goes Wes Craven, then Peter Jackson, in my opinion.
Fair.
And then Tolkien third.
Yeah. Definitely.
We've been going for too long at this point. But yeah, that was it. Like, it's taken
that long.
We've been
going too long on this podcast, too long on this review for Wes Craven, 3 odd years, too long on the podcast in general. Like, yeah.
But like I say, it would be fun, because there are these weird little things, like I say, even just looking it up, I kind of want to see this first movie from 1978, and who knows, we even discussed, like, doing it. I know we kind of just did a mini version of it there, like a Nightmare on Elm Street Scream, and I honestly feel like we just couldn't. I don't know, I would almost dread that in some ways, of trying to recontextualize it, because I think we've done it now. But I think, those other, even if we don't necessarily rank them, I would love to just check them out. But I think at this point, fuck it, let's just put them in the list. So that is it, though. That is the official ranking done, which is cool. So like I say, make sure you check all these out. They're all available on the feed. Obviously, it started with the first Scream, the first four Scream movies, around episode 200, which shows you how long ago that was. And then obviously we've done it in release order. So it was, what, Last House on the Left until... this week's episode, My Soul to Take. So yeah, man, what an adventure. Like, it's awesome. Like, I'm so glad we done this, and we couldn't have ever done it. We joked in the past about doing, like, other directors and stuff, but it never would have been this enjoyable. Right. I think this journey, having, like, the pinnacle of some of our favorite movies, having movies we've never seen before, then having just some, like, real shitters in there as well. Like, I think just the variety made this so enjoyable for me.
We don't get this again with anyone else.
No, definitely not, because we don't have that passion for anyone else. Like, say, it'd be great to do, like, the only other one is someone like Rob Zombie, but we've already done that. We've talked about his films so much. You know, most of them we've done episodes on, and then even, I think it was, what, episode 100, we, like, ranked them at the time.
I was going to say, I know there's been, like, ranked them at the time, and then we've done every, we've spoke about every other movie since, like.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, this was just perfect. But yeah, that was a great time. But yeah, that was our ranking, our final ranking. We'll take a quick break and we will be right back. Oh man, that is it. I feel exhausted. These episodes. Yeah, they're so awesome, but they're very tiring in a good way. Yeah, it's weird. Like, it always felt like it was a continuation of, like, you know, we'd do these sort of every couple of months, and I'd always be excited or nervous to see what was next. And it's wild that it's like, I know we have these side films, but like the actual, what we set out to do is over now. It's crazy. Yeah. Wow. It's sad, man. Like, I liked the fact that I've discussed time and time again that there's so many of my favorite directors I've not seen a lot of their films. Mm. You know, like, I've not seen, you know, many Hitchcock films and many of these other directors. So it was always exciting to me because, again, especially with someone like Wes, that you know that there's only a finite amount of them. And that's what's cool, I guess, about these TV stuff is, like, they're still out there. So I still have that feeling, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, I almost don't want to see them all because I don't want to ever get to a point where I've seen everything Wes has made.
But I kind of do now, like you, where we've gone this far, where I do just want to see that other
stuff. Yeah. I do as well. Because, like I say, there are other directors that I'll save for a rainy day where there will just be, like, a film, you know, where, like, oh, I'll save this. Like, there's, you know, there's many Hitchcock films I've not seen. Whereas, yeah, with Wes, we've come this far now, I feel like, and especially because it's all catalogued, that's a cool aspect of it. Mm. That, like, maybe our thoughts 3 years ago on some of these films is different to what it would be today. So that's another cool aspect of it. But yeah, the one thing I was going to quickly mention, only very briefly, because we've already gone along, and I know I did kind of discuss it last week with the game, but I did rewatch Texas Chainsaw Massacre over the past week. Just phenomenal. Like, it's one of those films that my opinion never changes on it. Like, I always expect to be like, oh, is this not as good as I remember? I don't know why. Again, maybe it is like that sequelitis and stuff and putting it on a pedestal, but it's just perfect from the moment it begins. Especially when Hitchhiker enters the film, I'm just like in love with it.
I think it is because, you know, you watch these films and you're like, you know, when you don't watch them, you just talk about them, you're like, oh yeah, they're the greatest. Mm-hmm. You know, they are in the conversation of the greatest horror movie of all time. So when you watch it, you're like, is it really? Because I think I've watched this one enough where I'm like, oh no, it is. Like, Scream and Nightmare on Elm Street. But like the two for me that I always watch where I'm nervous and then I watch them and I'm like, what the fuck was I worried about? Is The Shining and Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
Like the amount of times that like I talk up Silence of the Lambs, and every time I go to watch Silence of the Lambs, I'm like, oh, I don't think this is going to be really good. I don't think, not very good, but like, I'm not going to like be blown away by it and love it. And then like it starts and I'm like, this is a fucking masterpiece. What was I thinking?
Yeah. It's funny. I think all those films you just mentioned, I would then add Psycho and Dawn of the Dead to that list. And I think to me, unless I'm forgetting something obvious, if we were to have a debate of what I think is the greatest of all time, it would be all those, whatever, is that 7 or 8? Was it Scream, Nightmare, Dawn, Psycho, Texas, Lambs? Is that 6?
It feels like
it's more than that. But yeah, whatever all those films we just listed, like, again, unless there's something obvious that I'm missing. And again, modern era gets tricky, but like for me, those would be the big heavy hitters.
Definitely.
And yeah, like every time I watch them, I'm always blown away. Like every time I rewatch Psycho, and which is every year, I always love it. And then yeah, Texas is one that I think it's because I haven't watched Texas in a while. Mm. You know, I've probably seen the last at least two sequels since I went back to the original.
Yeah, that's always a problem.
Yeah, and like even the Netflix one that had some fun shit in it, the one before that, Leatherface, was an absolute abomination. But yeah, it was it was so good. Like, I love how it builds and builds and builds. Then you just get like 10 to 15 minutes of absolute chaos,
yeah,
where everyone just gets wrecked, yeah, other than Sally. Like, literally everyone gets destroyed so unceremoniously with like almost no fight back. It's so astonishing to see that in a horror film with the villains just overpower them so easily. And then you just get like 25 minutes of madness. Just absolute madness of like the cook when he gets re-put back into the film, and all of his interactions with the family are just so good. And then lead into that finale, which is perfection, like arguably the greatest ending of any film. Like, I love it. It's magical. And as I said last week, I think the authenticity of that movie is like that, and Blair Witch are the two that I always think when I think of that word specifically with films, because they're the two that I believe, like, even though I know they're not real. When I watch Chainsaw and when I watch Blair Witch, I still believe they're real.
Yeah, but they're so interesting for different reasons, because Blair Witch tricked you into thinking it was real and did everything else. Texas Chainsaw Massacre was real.
Like, yeah,
they got as close to killing her as you could. And, well, like, and you couldn't do it now, but back then, like, they got as close as you could. They put the cast through living hell.
And yeah, those times she jumps through the window looks so brutal. It's crazy.
My God, they look so painful, and just so many things about it, and just everything just looks so hot and disgusting, and like they actually use body parts for like some of it, and like rotten animal carcasses and stuff. Like, it, the whole shoot just sounded fucking horrific, and it's just encapsulated in the movie perfectly, you know. But. But yeah, so you know, it doesn't surprise me that that is what you'd say is the most authentic movie of all time, because it's because it absolutely is, like, other than an actual snuff movie.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I never even thought about it like that, but you're absolutely true. It is like almost watching a documentary. Mm. And like I say, it is the case of the Blair Witch tricked you into thinking that, whereas Texas is just raw. It is just that real thing. And like I say, it was from a different era. I mean, it's crazy to think the next year is the 50th anniversary of that film.
Wow. They do something.
Yeah, I do too, especially with the game. I really hope the game does some cool stuff. But yeah, it's... God, these films that are that old, like, I always think of Psycho, obviously, because it's just so old and I love it so much. But these films that still have this allure that long after the fact, like, I love it. I mean, it's crazy that out of all those, clearly Silence of the Lambs is the most recent. Mm. And, I mean, that's over 30, right? That was, like, around, what, 91, 92? So it's, you know, it's over 30 years old, like... Mad that 30 is the newer of these, and then you get to 50 years Chainsaw, you get to 60 years old in Psycho. It's I love it, man. I hope that these films are still as powerful when they're like 100 years old. That's so cool.
I think they will be now.
I think so as well. There's no way, like, I don't know why suddenly Psycho would stop being one of the greatest films ever made. Like, it's not, it will always be one of those.
No, I think we're past the point now where the effects and everything has gotten to a level that, like, it's not going to get like significantly better, and these movies still don't look shit.
Yeah, exactly. They were still filmed at a caliber with a level of acting and a level of like lighting, so you can actually see what's like eligible on screen.
You know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when she gets put on that hook and you see nothing. It's one of the most violent things I've ever seen in my life. And all it is her just being lifted up and dropped down.
Yeah.
But it's the way it's acted, the way it's shot, and that like just like nails on a chalkboard noise as well, that just like it's brutal. It like that is the thing, like when I rewatched Texas after someone was like, you know, there's almost no blood like in any of the kills. I'm like, fuck off, it's bloody as hell. And then you watch her get put on the hook and it's just like nothing. But
it's not a very violent movie in general, like in terms of, you know, what you see on, you know, graphic violence.
But it's incredibly violent from what you just know is going on.
Yeah, and it's also the sound, like the score is amazing that Toby Hooper also did. But like it's like that last 20 minutes of chaos where you've got Cook being the only one that can really put together somewhat coherent sentences. But it's just like the noises that Leatherface is making, whether it's the giggling or the screaming or the like maniacal laughter. It's just, it's so loud with the, and especially with Hitchhiker going fucking mental as well. Like it's, God, it's so good. I do want to check out 2 because I've not seen 2 in ages. And obviously it's like, Cook is in it and he's in it more with the same actor coming back, which is I'm really excited to see. And also obviously you get Bill Moseley as Chop Top, which is spectacular, so I do want to watch 2 because I haven't watched that. I think I've only seen that maybe once, like, God, 15 years ago or something, probably longer. So again, it's one of those movies that I've seen, but other than those people are in it, Dennis Hopper's in it, I couldn't tell you like anything about the story.
No, when you see Leatherface on top of a moving car, like with the chainsaw, you'll be like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, that sounds great. But yeah, that is it for another week. We're getting close now to the big boys. Obviously, we're only a couple of weeks away from a new Saw film.
Oh, yeah.
Not only a new Saw film, a new Saw film that looks good, question mark.
Ooh, I know.
I don't think we're ready for that. Like,
crazy, right?
But who knows? We've lived through, you know, some great films in our favorite franchises, some not so great films. Let's hope it's one of the better ones. I have faith, but I'm not getting giddy like the last two. I'm not. Pull me twice. Yeah. Shame on the people making Saw at this point. But yeah.
We may be getting a little preview up of a TV show soon as well, hey?
Yeah, very exciting. Like I say, we've got loads of stuff to talk about soon, and Shudder is bringing the bangers. But yeah, I may or may not have already seen some of a certain TV show returning next month. But stay tuned, because we're going to be talking all about Creepshow. But yeah, we'll get to that in the coming weeks. But yeah, that was episode 362. Thanks for listening as always, and we'll see you again very soon.
See you later, everyone. Shut up, I can't. Mainly because I never could. And how could I start that?